On this edition of Celebrating Science, Paul Steinhardt on Impossible Crystals Made Possible. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Impossible Crystals, Paul Steinhardt tells the story of how the quasi-crystal pattern shattered previous symmetry restrictions and led the way to an infinite number of new patterns and structures, and possibly an entirely new class of materials. Professor Steinhardt is one of the leading theorists responsible for inflation theory and proposed the theory of how inflation could produce seeds for galaxy formation. He is currently the Albert Einstein Professor in Science at Princeton University.
I'm going to begin with a prologue, kind of an audience participation part of the talk, to sort of set up the discussion that's going to follow. So I'd like to imagine that you have been given the job of, let's say, tiling some large floor or some large wall, and you've been given all identical tiles. The tiles are in the shape of a parallelogram. The question is, can you tile the surface? Let's ignore the edges. Can you tile the surface smoothly by close packing those tiles together, full edge on full edge, without admitting any gaps or cracks or holes? Well, I think it's obvious that the answer is yes. You can probably envisage the solution. You can imagine packing them in an array like this, for example. This is an example of what we call a periodic array. Periodic means regularly repeating, or repeating with equal distances. And what we see is that along each direction, the parallelogram repeats, the tile repeats, with equal separations between parallelograms. One kind of separation when you move along one direction, a different separation when you move along the other direction. Well, if instead of giving you a parallelogram, I had given you a rectangle, what about then? Could you have tiled the floor with that, with a pile of tiles like that, in the same way, without any cracks or gaps? Well, some of you must have already realized the answer must be yes, because a rectangle is just a special example of a parallelogram, which happens to have right angles rather than arbitrary angles. And so, in fact, you can do it. But there is something now a little bit different about this example, because a rectangle has the property that if I take a rectangle and rotate it by 180 degrees, I get back the same form as I had initially. And similarly, if I take this lattice of tiles and I flip it around 180 degrees, it too gets back to where it has the same form that it had initially. So by using a rectangle rather than a parallelogram, I not only make something periodic, but I make something with more symmetry. In this case, the symmetry of a rectangle, or what we call a twofold symmetry, because I can rotate it by 180 degrees and 180 degrees again to get back to where I started. How about a square? Well, again, that's just a special example of a parallelogram, so of course we can do it. Any of you that's tiled a bathroom with square tiles knows this. But now we've introduced more symmetry, because a square is not only remaining invariant when I rotate it by 180 degrees, but it's invariant when I rotate it by any multiple of 90 degrees. So I ended up with a periodic tiling, but this one, which now has an even higher symmetry, the symmetry of a square. Okay, now, how about a triangle? How many people think, raise your hand if you think you could tile the floor without any cracks or gaps with a triangle? Okay, almost everybody thinks yes, I think. How many people think no? Okay, nobody. It's got some no's. Well, you can. Well, you can. Okay, but it's a little bit more subtle, as you might notice, because now I've had to introduce not just triangles with one orientation, but one with a flipped orientation. But nevertheless, I can do it. I can fill the plane without any gaps. And now if I look at Of course, the triangle has a symmetry of rotations by 120 degrees. So now if I take this tiling and I rotate it by 120 degrees by the center, around the center of any triangle, I again get back to where I started. So again, I get a tiling with, in this case, the symmetry of a triangle. A hexagon, how many people don't think you can do a hexagon? Yeah, bees know you can do hexagons. They figured out to do it, so certainly you know it could be done. So again, one can close packs things. So in this case, of course, it has the symmetry of a hexagon. Rotations by 60 degrees would take you back to where you started again. Pentagon, how many people think you can do a pentagon? How many people think you can't do a pentagon? Yeah, people aren't so sure about this case, huh? Well, turns out that this is the first interesting case because you can't tile space with pentagons. You can't tile a plane with pentagons. You can tile the surface of a sphere with pentagons, but you can't tile a flat plane with pentagons without introducing cracks or holes in it. So our success rate up to this point has been 100%, but now suddenly we've come to a shape where we can't tile space with it. We could go to higher symmetry, like a heptagon, seven-sided figure. How many people think you could tile with a heptagon? Nah, no one's so sure anymore, huh? Okay. Well, you can't. In fact, we've completed the full list of tile shapes with which you could tile the plane, identical tile shapes with which you could tile the plane. The only kinds of tilings you can construct which are periodic, which have exactly equal intervals between tiles, and which you have no cracks and holes, are tilings with the symmetry of a parallelogram, a rectangle, a square, a triangle, and a hexagon, and nothing else. So not a pentagon, not a heptagon, not an octagon, not a 43-fold symmetry object, or what have you. That's the complete list. Now this simple observation, this simple mathematical observation, said in a somewhat more esoteric way 200 years ago, led to the following scientific breakthrough. It was realized when you look at this list of symmetries that were allowed that it corresponds exactly with the symmetries you find when you look at the crystal facets of a crystal. That is to say, if you look at crystal facets, they come in various forms, but they always have either the symmetry of a parallelogram, rectangle, triangle, hexagon, or square, and nothing else. And so what that suggested to people 200 years ago is that the internal structure of a crystal must be that there's a fundamental building block that simply repeats over and over again with equal spacing, with periodic spacing, in order to make the structure. Now today we would know that building block as being an atom or a molecule, but this is 200 years ago. There was no theory, there was no agreement that matter was made of atoms. In fact, that was just one of many possible hypotheses. But this was the first observational evidence, indirect though it may be, that matter, in particular crystals, but in general matter, is made of atoms or molecules, is made up of fundamental, indivisible building blocks. And not only that, but in the case of crystals, those building blocks are arranged in, so that they exactly repeat over and over again with equal spacing in this kind of periodic order. Now, this discovery, which came about from this simple mathematics, simple observations of crystals known in nature and simple physical reasoning, founded not only the idea that matter is made of atoms, but also founded a new science, the science of crystallography, a science that gives us the power to understand why materials have the properties that they have. In essence, it means that to understand any particular crystal, essentially all I have to do is figure out what the building block consists of. We would say nowadays, what arrangement of atoms and molecules it consists of. And once I've understood that, I understand the entire structure, since the entire structure is simply a repetition of that. And furthermore, by knowing that building block and knowing enough about the physics and chemistry of that particular building block, I can infer everything about the electronic, physical, elastic, and other properties of that material. So this is the founding. So this relationship between periodic tilings in crystals is a sort of founding principle in our understanding of materials of all forms and in our use of materials, be it silicon in its use in Blackberries and in other communications and computer devices, and in fact, all the materials that you see around you. And so, because it's such an important idea, if you open up almost any book, any basic book, textbook on the science of materials or solid-state physics, you'll find the first issue they address is this issue of what symmetries are allowed, based on this sort of tiling argument I gave you, and what structures are, and what kind of facets and structures are allowed for crystals. Well, that's a prologue for my talk, because what I'm going to explain to you in the rest of the talk is those things that you learn in those elementary textbooks are actually wrong, or at least incomplete. Because what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this talk is a set of objects which would be impossible according to those laws, those 200-year-old laws. And this is the idea we've called here in the title, impossible crystals. A group led by Danny Shechtman was assigned to take mixtures of aluminum with various metals from the periodic table, hundreds of them, thousands of mixtures of them, and make crystals of them, study their facets, study their structure, and determine, you know, what their chemical makeup was, what their structure was, determine what the repeating building block was. In the process of this study of going through thousands of alloys and seeing classifying their crystal forms, they found this material. Now, what you're seeing mostly in this picture is actually pure aluminum. What I want you to focus your eyes on are these sort of feathery-looking things that are sitting embedded in that aluminum. That's the material we're talking about, these grains of aluminum manganese. And they have a kind of slow snowflake appearance, but what is striking about them, or at least it's striking, let's say, for example, about this one, is that it seems, at least to the eye, superficially, to have a five-fold symmetry. And we just proved to ourselves that five-fold symmetry is impossible for crystals, is impossible for any kind of matter which is made from repeating building blocks. Now, just seeing a picture like that isn't convincing. To really convince yourself what the symmetry is, what you do is you perform a kind of what we call an electron diffraction experiment. We scatter electrons through a grain of this material and look at the scattering pattern it produces, because that scattering pattern reveals the order and symmetry of the solid that the electrons pass through. So, for example, if you pass electrons through a cubic crystal, it will produce a lattice of sharp spots, whose sharpness indicates that the structure is made from exactly repeating elements over and over again with equal spacing. And furthermore, the pattern of spots, if I shoot the electrons along an axis of, say, four square symmetry, the patterns of spots will have a square pattern of spots. What happened in this case, though, is they got a pattern like this. They got a pattern which had sharp spots. These are sharp. The reason why they look kind of broad is simply that they overexposed the film, but they're actually quite sharp. But when you look at the symmetry of this pattern, it reveals something which was shocking, at least at the time. If you look at, for example, at these spots over here, they form a ring of spots. If you count them as they go around, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10-fold symmetry, one of the many disallowed symmetries for crystals, even though the patterns are sharp, which is indicating that it's ordered like a crystal. There's some regular ordering to the sample. And then if you look more closely, you might even be able to pick out pentagons and decagons in the pattern as well. So this pattern was a real puzzle to them. All they could say is that it disobeyed the laws of crystallography, but they had no explanation for how this was possible, what the internal structure would be that would allow this. Now, as it turned out, I should also say that this shows that along the axis in which this experiment was done, the material had the symmetry which has a tenfold pattern. So that means it's either a pattern with five-fold symmetry, or it's either a structure with five-fold symmetry or tenfold symmetry. You can't tell from just looking at one pattern, since they would both give a pattern of spots with the same symmetry. So to determine what the full symmetry really is, you want to take this material and now rotate it in the microscope and perform the diffraction experiment again. When they did that, they found that they could reconstruct this full snowflake pattern, and it gave a pattern like this. that did not just have one five-fold symmetry axis, but as you can see, had many five-fold symmetry axes. So it didn't just obey the laws of crystallography once, it actually disobeyed the laws of crystallography actually six times over. It has six independent five-fold symmetry axes. And the axes are not just at arbitrary angles, they're at rather special angles. They're the same angles you would find if you were to take a soccer ball and look at the centers of the pentagons in the soccer ball. The five-fold symmetry axes of this grain are in exact alignment with the pentagons in the surfaces of a soccer ball. Now, a solid with this symmetry is said to have an icosahedral symmetry, because an icosahedron is a three-dimensional figure which has six five-fold symmetry axes, the same symmetry as a soccer ball, the same symmetry as a dendritic grain. The word icosahedron comes from hedra, meaning faces, and icosa, meaning 20, so the name tells you its shape. It has 20 identical triangular faces, 30 identical edges, and it has 12 five-fold symmetry axes. So around the center of each triangular face, there's an axis of three-fold symmetry. That's perfectly consistent with crystallography. Around every edge, there's in the center of it, a center of two-fold symmetry, the symmetry of a rectangle. That's perfectly consistent with crystallography. But the icosahedron, if you look down a vertex, has a five-fold symmetry axis, and it has six independent ones. And so it is a super forbidden for crystals, the most forbidden symmetry possible. It's the highest symmetry, the most number of five-fold symmetry axes you can have. The answer to the puzzle for explaining these materials, or a potential answer, was laying in the wings. At the same time that this group, Danny Schechtman and his group at the National Bureau of Standards outside Washington, were exploring this and trying to understand their puzzling grain of aluminum manganese, my student and I at the University of Pennsylvania were working on the idea of a hypothetical new kind of solid that we thought could violate the laws of crystallography. And we call these things quasicrystals. We wanted to make something which was as close to a crystal as possible, but didn't have to obey the standard rules of symmetry. They could break those 200-year-old rules. Of course, most people assume that that was impossible based on the proofs, the 200-year-old proofs, but we had a notion of how we might get around those constraints. So we still wanted to have something which had an orderly arrangement, and in particular, when you diffracted electrons through it, would give you sharp spots. We still wanted to have something that had a clearly defined rotational symmetry. In fact, we wanted to get rotational symmetries that are normally impossible for crystals. We also wanted the structure to be what I might call simple, simple in the sense that it's made from repeating building blocks. So we wanted to have all those properties, but we wanted to break those rules of 200-year-old rules. To do that, we introduced one substantial change, which had to do with the ordering of the elements. Instead of considering structures or tilings, or atomic arrangements which were periodic, we switched to thinking about ones which are what are called quasi-periodic. Now, quasi-periodic means that there's not a single repeating distance between elements. There's two or maybe three or some other finite number of them. But not only that, but when it looks at the different distances, their ratio is not a rational number. It's an irrational number. That means it can't be expressed as a ratio of integers. So, of course, 2 is an integer, and it's a ratio of integers, 2 divided by 1. 7/6 is a rational number because it's a ratio of integers, 7 to 6. But numbers like the square root of 2, square root of 5, etc., those are examples of irrational numbers. When you express them as decimals, the decimal never repeats, and they can never be expressed as a ratio of integers. So we had the idea that you might have, for example, a structure which is defined by two regular repeating repetitions whose ratio was an irrational number. And then we showed you could get around the rules, the 200-year rules about rotational symmetry. New symmetries are possible, including five-fold symmetry in the plane, seven-fold symmetry in the plane, 43-fold symmetry in the plane, and the super forbidden case of icosahedral symmetry in three dimensions. The other element, or slight change to the standard rules, is that we imagine that we didn't have to stick with structures which just had a single repeating element. They might have two, or a finite number of repeating elements. That would be a way, by having elements of different sizes, of getting sort of two lengths in the problem whose ratio would be irrational. So essentially, what quasi-periodic means, what would be analogous in music, would be disharmony, to choose two frequencies which are not harmonics of one another. A quasicrystal is the analog in space. It's a disharmonic crystal, if you like, with at least two repeating intervals whose ratio is irrational. Now, our inspiration for thinking about this idea came from a tiling that was first produced by a physicist by the name of Roger Penrose, who is also a member of our Scientific Advisory Committee. In fact, is one of the founding members of the Scientific Advisory Committee. And when Roger made this tiling, well, he actually had no interest in crystals. He didn't actually know the tiling he made was quasi-periodic. What he was trying to do was solve a certain kind of puzzle that had been around for, decades. The goal of the puzzle, or the idea of the puzzle, was, can you find a set of shapes which can only tile the plane non-periodically? So we know we can take shapes and, with some combinations, tile them periodically or non-periodically. The question is, could you find a set of shapes which, when you put them together, are forced by the way that they join to one another to only tile the plane non-periodically? And this is the tiling that he produced. And notice I said non-periodically. I didn't say anything about quasi-periodic, because that was not what they had in mind. Simply not periodic. No, not a single repeating interval was all they had in mind. Now, you might look at this and say there's something a little bit funny about this, because, it's made of these two units, which are rhombuses, a skinny one and a fat one. And we just said before that I can take a skinny rhombus, say, or a fat rhombus, and I can tile them periodically. So the tiling is not quite as simple as I've shown it on the left. In order to force it to be non-periodic, you have to impose some rules which only allow the pieces to meet along some ways and not other ways, in such a way as to prevent it from making any kind of periodic pattern. So how do you impose those rules? Well, there are various ways. There are lots of schemes which are variations of the same basic idea. One way is to take the sides of those tiles there and curve them a bit so that they kind of only interlock in some ways but not in other ways, so they can't meet up in all possible directions. So that was kind of the way Penrose thought about it. In fact, he made a particularly clever version of it. Well, we'll see if you think it's clever or silly, but in which the tiles actually have a recognizable shape, which is in the shape of chickens. These are called Penrose chickens. And they have interlocks. They're shaped in such a way that they have kind of interlocks, so that, for example, I can take two of these fat chickens, and I can tile them together that way. And then I can take one of these skinny chickens and put it in there. Here's another skinny chicken. Here's a fat chicken. Okay, so. And so the interesting thing about these rules, and if you the more you think about it, the more amazing it is. The interesting thing about these rules is that, number one, they do allow you to fill the entire plane as much as you want. But number two, it's purely non-periodic. Never, every time you think the pattern's going to regularly repeat, you follow it far out enough, it stops regularly repeating. Something changes out there that makes the pattern not repeat. So it's really quite an amazing construction. So I have a whole box of these tiles, which I'll leave on this, which I'll leave here, and you're welcome to come and play afterwards. This is a very toy-intensive talk. I warn you that in advance. And you'll see when you try to play with them that actually it's quite non-trivial. Putting them together is quite a non-trivial task. In fact, we'll come back to that point in a moment. Now, the problem with this way of showing the tiles is, although it's a lot of fun, it doesn't actually show you the hidden symmetry in the tiling. It's a much better way of enforcing these matching rules, rules which constrain the way you put them together, is the one shown here. This is the one we got interested in. It's to label each of the fat tiles with a certain arrangement of lines, each of the skinny tiles with a different arrangement of lines, but every fat tile the same way, every skinny tile the same way. And then we make the rule that when you join two tiles along an edge, you're only allowed to join them so that the lines continue across the interface. That, it turns out, prevents some joinings, like the ones which give you periodic tilings, and admits others, like the ones that give you the tiling on the left. But what's more important for our purposes is that when you join these things up this way, those little line segments end up revealing the hidden symmetry of the structure. So when I join them up, if I do this for each tiling, this is what happens. They form continuous lines through the whole structure. So your eye might have told you there was some hidden order to this, but now you know there's an order to it, because you now know, for example, when I put this tile down here with a little line segment along here, it forces an infinite alignment of tiles going out in this direction, and similarly in this direction, et cetera. So there is definitely, this is not a random structure. This is not simply a non-periodic structure. It's something much more special than that. Now, what is it? Well, if you look at the patterns of lines, you find there are five of them, each one of them parallel to one of the edges of a pentagon. Furthermore, the sequence of lines in each of those five directions turns out to be the same. So now you have explicit proof that the structure really has an overall global five-fold symmetry, the famous symmetry that's disallowed for crystals. You may have believed that because you saw some pentagonal shapes in there, but believe me, you can make lots of shapes with pentagonal motifs which are not five-fold symmetric. Islamic art is full of such structures, and they turn out to be actually periodic patterns, but just with pentagonal motifs. This is something really different. This is legitimately a pattern which has an infinite five-fold symmetry. Now, if we look at the pattern of lines along any one direction, you discover something else interesting about them, which is that there's not a single separation between them, but there's also not an infinite number of them. There's only two possible separations, what we call a long or a short separation. Okay, so each interval between lines when you produce this structure is either long or short. The ratio of the long to the short lengths, the ratio of those lengths, is an irrational number. So that's our first hint of quasi-periodicity. It's not square root of 2, it's not square root of 5, it's a number which, well, can be written as 1 plus the square root of 5 divided by 2. That may not be immediately recognizable to you. But what if I tell you that number is the golden ratio? Okay, that is the famous golden ratio that nature uses in designing the seeds in sunflowers or the shape of a nautilus shell, or that the Greeks thought was the ideal ratio of the height to width of a human being, and is used in art. And it also appears as part, it's also related to, if you have a pentagon, it's related to the circle that inscribes the pentagon compared to the edge length of the pentagon, etc. So it's a famous rational number. Now, something else interesting. If you follow the sequence of those longs and shorts, well, this is sort of typically what you see. At first, it looks like this, you have some sort of repeating pattern. Long, short, long, short. But then it's long, long. Just when you thought you had gotten the rhythm, it breaks the rhythm. And you'd find that if we made the pattern arbitrarily long, that would always be the case. Occasionally, it looks like it's settling into a rhythm, and all of a sudden, something happens to break the rhythm. As you study the pattern more closely, you discover that, in fact, there's something quite subtle going on. If you count the number of longs as you go along and the number of shorts as you go along, you find that they follow a ratio. There's a certain ratio, which is a ratio, of course, of integers, but famous integers, integers known as the Fibonacci numbers. So a famous set of integers that have been studied for over 1,000 years, which have the property that as you choose Fibonacci numbers of higher and higher order, the ratio approaches an irrational number. A ratio of integers which, in a sequence, approaches an irrational number, and not just any irrational number, but the golden ratio. Okay? So what does that mean? That means that the frequency in which L's appear and the frequency with which S's appears are relatively irrational. Their ratio is irrational. In fact, their ratio is the golden ratio. Now, that means that can never happen in a periodic structure. In a periodic structure, if you settle into any repetition, the ratio is going to be some ratio of integers that remains fixed throughout. It could never be an irrational number. So this is a proof, if you like, a geometrical proof, that what you've got is something which is not crystalline, is five-fold symmetric, and is quasi-periodic. has two periods, two regular intervals whose ratio repeat with relatively, with a frequency whose ratio is an irrational number. Now, once you understand that's what's really going beyond the behind the Penrose tiling, it turns out it's pretty easy to show that you can now make tilings with, well, arbitrary symmetry. So here, for example, is our Penrose tiling consisting of our two tiles, fat and skinny tiles. But here's one with sevenfold symmetry, which happens to have three tiles, three different rhombus tile shapes. Here's one with 11-fold symmetry. Here's one with, I think, 17-fold symmetry. Now, these are very pretty patterns, wonderful quilt patterns, for example. I have a nice quilt of one of these patterns. But I should say that the picture you're seeing of them here is a little bit deceiving because I've intentionally gone to a place in the pattern where there's a local center of symmetry, so it's easy for you to see the symmetry. If you sort of focus on a corner out here, and imagine that's all you saw, the thing looks very random. You wouldn't guess that it really had this hidden quasi-periodicity and symmetry. So these things are really quite subtle. And what we were especially interested in was three-dimensional patterns, because we had in mind making new kinds of solids. So we were particularly interested in the fact that you can also make the most forbidden symmetry, a three-dimensional structure with icosahedral symmetry. Now, for the icosahedral case, the situation is, when you go up one dimension, it's actually significantly more complicated than the two-dimensional case, although there's a lot of analogs. In this case, instead of needing two fundamental building blocks like we needed for the Penrose tiling, it turns out that we need four. Yeah, this guy's show up a little bit. Unfortunately, one of them is white. maybe I can get something. Well, you'll get to see it soon enough. Now, this set of shapes is a set of shapes, four different shapes, all of which have faces whose outline is the same shape. Each of them is a rhombus. So in principle, if they were smooth surfaces, any face could match on any face. They're actually a famous family of shapes, famous at least among geometers, set of shapes which are known as zonahedra. They get their name for the following reason. If I take the first one of these, okay, this particular one is called the rhombic triacontahedron. Okay, so now that you've got your quick on your Greek, you have already realized that hedron means face and triacontra means 30, so this has 30 rhombic faces. It's a rhombic triacontahedron. Okay, and you notice it has five-fold symmetry axes. And I'm going to pass this around, so you'll have a chance to see this up close. Another interesting cute thing about it is if you hold it by its tips, okay, I'm not sure I can reproduce this here exactly. If you hold it by two opposite tips, what you'll find is that there's a band of rhombuses that run around its center that kind of go up and down. Okay, I'm kind of rolling it along this band. I'm not sure if you can see that or not, but you'll be able to see it when you see it up close. If you imagine cutting out that band of rhombuses and gluing the two pieces together, you would end up with this shape. Okay, this shape is known as a rhombic icosahedron. So remember, icosa means 20, so it's a 20-faced rhombic surface. And again, if you hold it by its tips, you will see there's a band of rhombuses that run throughout it, its belt. And if you imagine cutting those out and gluing them together, you'll get to this shape, which is the rhombic dodecahedron. And yes, if you hold it by its tips and imagine cutting out the central band of rhombuses, you'll get to this shape, which is just the simple rhombohedron. So these shapes, because of this zone-like behavior, you can cut out the central zone and get from one to the other. That's how they get their name, zonahedra. That's one reason why they're interested in geometers. Another reason is that this particular shape, the rhombic triacontahedron, happens to be the shape you get if you take a cube in six dimensions and project it into three. Okay? So it's related to a projection from higher dimensions. So these actually have an amazing and interesting history to them, which actually does relate to quasicrystals, although I don't plan to pursue that relationship tonight unless you force me to. Okay, so now, here's the point. Here's the interesting thing about these particular shapes. You don't just have these shapes, but you notice, you can probably see on there, that they have these various slits and notches in them. And they're not all identical. A lot of them are identical, but some of them are not. Okay, let's see, let me get one that's not, okay? Some of them are not. That means I can join actually some of these faces together, but not others. The interesting thing is that if you want to fill this room with units like this, you could do it. But the only way you could do it, the only possible way you could do it, is in a non-periodic, icosahedrally symmetric quasicrystal lattice. So this is the three-dimensional analog of what we saw for the Penrose tiling. Much more subtle in the way it works, but it's the three-dimensional analog of the Penrose tiling. I'm not going to fill this room, but just so you can get an impression of what one of these things, what it would look like. Here's a, Here's a surface of what it would look like. So if you actually fill this room, look down a five-fold symmetry axis, what you'd find is that it forms layers, no two of which are identical, which would form a kind of crinkly surface which come from the joinings of these elements. If you looked at this thing, stare at it a little bit, and again, I'm going to pass this around, you might even notice that there are, that actually these little slots I've put into this to join them up actually form lines that run throughout the structure. And if you have a good imagination, you can imagine looking through it and even seeing planes running through the structure. And in fact, that idea is exactly right. The way these were obtained was just as before for the Penrose tiles, we had little line segments which we had to match up in order to force them to join together. Here, the analog in three dimensions happens to be planes. And the way we've shown the planes is through those slots. See, we had the idea that if you could make units which had forces, joints on them which can force the structure, maybe you can have atoms or molecules which make the same structure. And then you could have a new kind of material, a new kind of matter, a new kind of solid, which would have this icosahedral quasicrystal symmetry. So what we did is we figured out what would happen if you would diffract, for example, electrons through such a material, what it would look like. In the fall of 84, I went to IBM Research to try to convince people to look, try to see if they could make materials with this structure. It was a hard go because this is just a hypothetical idea based on this kind of toys. It's a hard effort to try to make a material or to imagine making a material with this structure. But while I was at IBM, I had a nice visit from a former collaborator, David Nelson from Harvard University, and he happened to be coming by IBM, and he knew I was working on something in this general area, although he didn't know quite what I was doing. But he said, he called me up and he said, I think I have a paper that might interest you. And so he came by my office and I said, but I have something I want to show you. He said, no, I want to show you this paper. I said, no, I want to show you this calculation. So we jockeyed around for a bit and he won. So he got to show me the paper, and I looked at this paper, which was this paper from Dan Shechtman showing those that material I showed you before, those grains I showed you before. And I was flipping through it and flipping through it. My eyes were getting wider and wider. And at some point, I think I must have just jumped up in the air, and I don't know what he was thinking at the time, why I did that. But basically, the reason why I did that was because, well, the pattern on the right is the pattern from that material I showed you. What I had wanted to show him was our calculation. We had just calculated what the diffraction pattern from an ideal quasicrystal should look like. And the thing on the left was the thing I wanted to show him. So it was one of those amazing moments, you know, when you're thinking working idea that you think is totally wild, and then suddenly it seems to have some basis in reality. It was quite a bit of fun, and eventually he understood why we were so excited. Why we're so excited. And of course, what attracted our attention was the fact that this theoretical calculation agreed so closely with the observational one. Now, I should point out the theoretical calculation shows more dots on the left than the one on the right, and that's because the theoretical calculation assumes an experiment which is much more accurate and with a material which is much more perfect than the material on the right. But to the level at which one can compare them, they are in one-to-one correspondence with one another. And so it neatly leads the suggestion by us that, in fact, maybe that what the explanation, the natural explanation for what they found is that it is indeed a quasicrystal, the first example of a quasicrystal ever seen by humans. Now, at first, this idea was grabbed onto. But after a few months, people began to become increasingly skeptical. They pointed out, for example, that although there seems to be pretty good agreement, I mean, at least superficially of the eye, there's pretty good agreement. In fact, you notice that these materials are not beautifully faceted like crystals. They're these highly disordered They're these highly disordered, feathery-like things. And although shortly after this first example was found, people began to make many other quasicrystals. Once they found one, they began to make other alloys, which had icosahedral symmetry and gave a similar diffraction pattern. All of them were these kinds of feathery-looking affairs. And furthermore, all of them are what we call metastable. That is to say that if you cool things quickly, you can make them. But if you give the atoms enough time to relax, they tend to form crystals. And so it began to make people skeptical that quasicrystals really can be achieved. Maybe you can get close to them. Maybe that's what has happened here. But true quasicrystals that would have this true beautiful order may, in fact, be impossible. Not only did they have the fact that they couldn't make them in the laboratory, but they had two pretty solid theoretical arguments. The first was that in order to grow one of these structures, in order to actually fill the room with those tiles, it looks like you need some kind of non-local interactions. What I mean by non-local interactions is the following. Suppose I left you with you come up afterwards and you try to make the Penrose tile with those chicken tiles, okay? Now, you can do it in principle, but what you're going to find in practice is when you start to put, five or 10 of them together, you're going to find that you run into a conflict, a disagreement. What you tiled on one end will disagree with what you tiled on the other end, and you're going to have to take some away and start, make a different choice and start again. In fact, you'll find you have to do this over and over and over again. The only way you could avoid that is if you had in mind the global picture of what the ideal tiling is like and could look ahead and make sure when you put a tile over here, it wasn't going to conflict with the tile that you were laying over here, which implies some kind of long-range interaction between the two. You're using your eye in this case, but what are the atoms and molecules doing when they make this structure? Are they somehow looking over long distances in order to decide whether to fit here or here in this way? Well, the atoms we're talking about are very simple atoms, metal atoms, which, as far as we know, don't have these long-range interactions. So the fact that they seem to require these long interactions is a serious problem, suggesting that maybe you can't really get to these perfect quasicrystals. A second argument is that the structure is very complicated. You can already see that when you see the pieces going around. The way they join together is rather complicated. You need several units. How did these atoms figure out to make two kinds of units that only fit together in certain ways? How do they figure out how to do that? It seems too complicated compared to a crystal, which just has a single repeating unit. These are good arguments, and I now want to turn to them, because it turns out that the subject of quasicrystals didn't just have one surprise, the one I've already presented you, the fact that they exist, but in these issues, there were further surprises to be found. So let me first of all talk about this issue of the non-local interactions. Let me just convince you that there really is a problem here. And we'll do it by doing not a problem of tiling the plane, because that would take a lot of space. We'll think about a much simpler problem, which is the problem of making a chain in one dimension, what I will call a Fibonacci chain. A chain of long and short links, which follows that same sequence of longs and shorts that we saw in the Penrose pattern, in which the ratio of longs to shorts follows a ratio of Fibonacci numbers. Here I've shown you a good piece of the pattern that you can be calculated. There's a global sort of expression which gives you what an infinite pattern would look like. Here's a piece of that infinite pattern. That's the ideal that you're shooting for. However, the way we want to grow our chain is not to simply copy that pattern, because that would be easy. What we want to do is make a set of rules. We want to develop a set of rules which tells us when to add a long and when to add a short such that we'll get this ideal chain. And furthermore, we want to make it that these rules don't require that I have to look all the way back along the chain. I should only have to look back 1, 2, maybe 10 elements, but a finite number of elements. Okay? Question: can I find a set of rules so that I only have to look back a finite distance to decide whether to add a long or short in such a way that I will get this ideal pattern? Now, I can use the ideal pattern to help guide my thinking, but I'm not allowed to just simply copy it, because that's using global information. I have to only use information about the end of the chain. Take this chain, for example. Long, short, long, long, short. Can I figure out what to add next, long or short? Well, yes, I can, because if I look at the ideal pattern, I can use that as a guide, I notice that a short is always surrounded on both sides by longs. You never have two shorts in a row. So I know, in this case, which one to do. Just by having a short at the end, I know the next element must be long. So that's an example of what I would call a local rule. If you think about it as atoms, it would only require local information about what's happening at the end of the chain to decide whether to add an atom of one type or an atom of another type. Or in the two dimensions, a tile of one type or a tile of another type. But here's the problem. The problem is you can always make chains like this one shown here. In this chain shown here, at the very end of the chain, I have a long, and I'm now faced with a decision. Am I supposed to add a long, or am I supposed to add a short? And if I add a short, it's going to be followed by a long. So I look at the ideal pattern for guidance. And what do I find? I find here's long, long, that's allowed. And here's long, short, long. So actually, both of them are allowed. I can't make a decision just by knowing there's a long on the chain, which one to add. So I'll go back two elements, short, long. So I can either have short, long, long, or short, long, short, long. What happens up here? Well, OK, here's short, long, long. And here's short, long, short, long. So again, I can't decide on the basis of having short, long at the end. Looking back two elements, which one to make. And I won't walk you through the whole thing. We could go back three and four and five and six and seven until we get to the end. And then all of a sudden, it makes a big difference which one we choose. In fact, that one is not allowed. And why? Because if I make that choice there, well, the bottom choice there, what will happen is I'll end up with a chain which goes long, short, long, short, long, long, short, long, short, long, long, short, long, short, long. It'll repeat the same motif three times. And that you'll never find in the ideal lattice. So that is disallowed. But the only way I could discover it was disallowed was to go all the way back to the end of the chain and reconstruct it. So I look back all those many elements. And I can make bigger chains and bigger chains and bigger chains which have the same property. We have to look all the way back to the end of the chain. So in fact, I can make a chain which says that you have to look back arbitrarily far in order to make the right decision. So there's a proof, an absolute proof. I've just done it by hand waving, but it's an absolute, it can be formulated into an absolute mathematical proof that you need infinite range information in order to ensure that you can build an infinite chain perfectly. And of course, in three dimensions, we have a problem that's much worse, because when we build the tiling, the Penrose tiling, we're building a lattice of lines which follows the sequence in five different directions at the same time. So this looks really impossible. And in fact, if I begin tiling the plane according to Penrose's rules, let's say I add a first tile, then I add a second tile following the joining rule, then a third and a fourth and a fifth, et cetera, then just as I described for the chickens, what you'll typically find is after a handful or so of tiles, I'll run into a problem. Okay? And the only way to get rid of that problem is either to look ahead to avoid the problem, okay, with a longer range interaction, or I have to keep taking stuff away and replacing it, taking stuff away and replacing it. So the fact that one cannot make these highly perfect, beautifully faceted, large quasicrystals seems to be understood perfectly from this simple geometrical argument. The only thing is, this argument turns out to be wrong. It's quite surprising that it's wrong. It's an example, again, where just when you think you understand what's going on in this subject, that's what I actually find so attractive about it. Every time I think I know what's going on, something surprising happens. So a few of us decided to ask the question, well, OK, maybe we have to make lots of mistakes in making quasicrystals. Maybe we can reduce their frequency. Maybe we can, instead of making a mistake once every 10 tiles, at least we can find a rule that makes it once every maybe 100 tiles. Let's see how far we can go. Okay, so we made a rule which, unlike the Penrose rules, which constrain the way two tiles can join along an edge, instead, well, it was a simple variant idea. It constrained the way you add tiles to a vertex. You think about all the tiles around a vertex, not just the one at the nearest edge. That's still a finite distance. It's a very close distance. But it's just different than Penrose's concept of constraining the way tiles join edge to edge. So in particular, if I have some tiling, which like the one you're going to make down here, and I look at the vertices on the surface, I can always divide them into what I'll call unforced and forced. Unforced means there's two or more choices that you can use to complete the vertex. Forced means there's only one choice. So our rule was very simply, only add tiles when you have forced sites and never add them when you have unforced sites. You can tell if it's forced or unforced just by looking at that vertex. You don't have to look any further, so it's a local rule. We made a little program that beginning from seed, I've just chosen one here, we'll simply add talented foresights, and we're going to see how far we can go before we make a mistake. So this program, the way it's designed, will stop either when you run out of foresights, or two, when you've actually made a mistake, when you have a conflict and you have to go back and start again. Okay? So remember, for the Penrose's rules, you'd already make a mistake actually for this many tiles, typically. Let's see how far we get here. One second. Okay, ready, set. Okay, I will run out of memory if I let it go. Amazingly, we've gone from making a tiling mistakes every so-and-so to making no mistakes. In fact, you can continue this tiling forever. It will continue to grow this way forever, perfectly, out to infinity, without ever making a mistake. So surprisingly, shockingly, the intuition that one had from the one-dimensional chain, the intuition that one had from thinking about the two-dimensional tiling with Penrose's rules, all that intuition is actually deceptive. With another set of rules, you can actually make something infinitely big. So in fact, there's actually no good theoretical reason why you can't make a perfect quasicrystal. And sure enough, within a year, people began to do just that. Suddenly, just by playing around with other materials, they began to make crystals that were suddenly stable, at least as far as we can tell, were stable, and could be grown to millimeter centimeter size, which were faceted with smooth facets. And here's one example. This particular material is one we'll be looking at a little bit later. It contains planes which have tenfold symmetry and then are stacked periodically. And they form spindles, which when you calculate the facets around the when you count the number of facets around the spindle, it are 10 identical facets. So this is a structure which forms actually a mixture of crystal and quasicrystal. Quasicrystal in the plane, periodic out of the plane, with tenfold symmetry. Here's an example of one, actually was discovered here in Canada, called, because it was part of a commercial alloy, and it makes faceted quasicrystals with the shape of a rhombic triacontahedron, that orange shape that we saw before, which are beautifully faceted. It turns out this material is already being used, or actually it's a piece of it's a certain grains of this material are can be found in the aluminum alloys that are used to make airplanes. So it was actually already in commercial use, in part, or at least part of a commercially used product, at the time that it was discovered that it's really a quasicrystal and not a crystal. Here's a beautifully decahedral grain of a quasicrystal, which clearly shows these beautiful flat facets and five-fold symmetry in the most explicit way. By the way, this shape, which is known as the dodecahedron, the regular dodecahedron, is the way you can tile with just pentagons. It's just that you have to tile in a curve on a sphere. And here's my favorite example, because of its beautiful complexity. Actually, you can predict the shapes. You can predict the possible shapes the quasicrystals can have. My students and I, you know, went through an exercise like this, and included getting very complicated shapes like the one shown here. But I never expected to actually see one of these things actually see in the laboratory. What's most amazing about this particular picture is that it's a kind of optical illusion. You have the impression that what you're looking at is a nugget, a beautifully faceted nugget of quasicrystal, like I just pick out like this. But that's actually not what you're looking at. This is the material here. This is a hole in the material. Okay? So it turns out that when you grow crystals or quasicrystals, for either one, and you have a lot of vacancies in the material, they tend to diffuse around if your temperature is high enough, and they tend to meet up with one another to form cavities inside the material. And the rule for the shapes or the physics that determines the shapes of the cavities they form is actually the same physical equations that describe the shapes for facets on the outside of a crystal. The idea that they require these lone local interactions turns out to be misleading, we discovered, and now we know we can actually make these things, or at least it looks like we can make these things in nature. Nevertheless, skepticism still remained due to this fact, that it still seems like they're awfully complicated. The idea that you need to have two shapes or more shapes that interlock in some way to do this seems awfully complicated. So, interestingly enough, we've learned recently that this, too, is not necessarily required. Certainly seems to be required. We're supposed to get these two lengths whose ratio is irrational. How are we going to do that if we don't have, if we only have a single shape? Well, it turns out there's another trick which is possible. And this is the idea of what we call coverings instead of tilings. In a covering, you have a repeating element, which I've called here a tile. But actually, it's more what we have in mind is not that, that unlike tiles, which join together edge on edge, we imagine that these repeating units are allowed to overlap one another. And instead of having rules for the way they join edge to edge, we have rules for the way they can overlap one another. So for example, an example I'm going to show here, we're going to begin with only have one unit. It's going to be this decagon. But notice that the decagon has been painted with these red and blue regions. We're going to make the rule that when you join these two tiles up one another, if you allow one to overlap the other, they can only overlap so that red overlaps red and blue overlaps blue. That, turns out, allows two possible joinings, one in which they're far separated, A, one in which they're more closely separated, B. And would it surprise you to know that the ratio of those distances is the golden ratio? Hope not. Okay. That's how you can generate two lengths from a single element, by constraining the way they're allowed to overlap. Of course, if you were trying to build a tiling for your bathroom, you would not want to have tiles which overlap one another, please. But if we're thinking about atoms, if you think about this as representing a cluster of atoms, then what this overlap would mean is simply that two clusters are sharing atoms, that you're getting two clusters for less than the price of two by allowing them to share some atoms and sort of hook onto one another. And it's just that the arrangement allows two ways for them to hook onto one another, one which brings them close and one of which makes them more distant, and where the ratio is the golden ratio. Now, it turns out if you follow this rule with just this single element, you can construct a space-filling tiling in a which is fivefold symmetric, quasi-periodic. In fact, you can actually map this directly into a Penrose tiling. It's what we call isomorphic mathematically to a Penrose tiling. So it's just an equivalent way of doing it, but now with just a single repeating motif. Furthermore, not only have you simplified sort of the way you describe the structure as being involving a single repeating motif, but also it suggests a reason why these things might form. You see, imagine that this cluster represents some arrangement of atoms, some cluster of atoms, which is highly energetically favored, which the system really wants to form. So when you cool the system, it wants to make as many of them as possible. Well, one possibility is to arrange that cluster so it joins the same way as it would in a crystal, just end on end, pack them crystallographically. But another possibility for some clusters is that they can pack themselves more densely by sharing atoms. Now, it turns out you can show that the overlap I've shown you actually gives you the maximal density of such clusters, or the minimum energy. So not only do we have a sort of new structural way of thinking about things, we have a kind of new simple energetics to explain why these things might form. And furthermore, nature seems to do this. Here is a cross-section, an atomic microscopy image using a technique which is known as high-angle annular dark field imaging, which shows the atoms of nickel and cobalt in a quasi-crystal mixture of aluminum, nickel, cobalt. It doesn't show the aluminum, but it shows the nickel and cobalt. I'm not sure what it seems like from your vantage point. It takes a little while to get used to it. But I point out that sitting within this image are nice little decagonal clusters. Here's a cluster of 10 atoms surrounded by another 10 atoms. In the middle there are three atoms. And there isn't just one of them. There's full of them. In fact, they overlap. In fact, they overlap in exactly the same way as the ideal pattern. If we close in on one of them, it's what I said. There's a ring of 10 surrounded by a ring of 10, surrounded by a ring of 3. That ring of 3 breaks the tenfold symmetry of the decagon. But of course, when we painted them with red and blue spots, we also broke the tenfold symmetry of the decagon. We used that as part of the joining rules. But the interesting thing is that you break the symmetry of the decagon in exactly the same way as you do the symmetry of the red and blue. That is to say, you break the tenfold symmetry into sort of a twofold reflecting symmetry. which means if I rotate my decagon by a multiple of 36 degrees, the outside comes into itself, but of course the inside does not. So as I move along this lattice of the decagons, I see these central motifs switching direction. And if I compare in the ideal pattern, the way as I go from one decagon to another, the direction shift for the ideal pattern to the way the actual atoms shift, I find that they are in one-to-one correspondence. So this thing is following the rules as closely as you can possibly imagine. Furthermore, we can then use this image to help discern the structure of the quasicrystal, which has been one of the long-standing mysteries. We've never quite deciphered until now what the atomic structure is, because when you think about them as being composed of two elements which join in different ways, we don't have enough information to decide which atoms belong to which element. But if we just have a single element which describes the entire structure, and we have this kind of imaging, and we know enough about the ratios of the elements in there, that gives us more than enough information to actually decipher the structure. So in fact, using this reasoning, we actually deciphered. We had a best fit to what the structure should look like. And it's a very complex structure, not the first thing that you would come to mind. But that seemed to be the unique solution that we found. And recently, people have been able to do much higher resolution imaging, which now reveals the aluminum as well as the nickel and cobalt with much greater accuracy. And it agrees spot on with what we had predicted based on the earlier analysis. So we now have our first example of what I'd call a solved quasicrystal, where we actually understand its structure, we understand how it can be growing from a single element by these overlap rules, and we also understand actually where the atoms sit in this structure. And this is what you need to sort of really open the door up to using these materials and technology. Now, it takes a long time between when you have a sort of hypothetical idea of a quasicrystal or the first examples of quasicrystal, and you can actually begin to use them, because you have to be able to have enough control that you can grow materials with the kinds of atoms, with the kinds of structures that you want for your application. But now we understand in a much simpler way, the structure of these solids and how they grow, and that we can grow them perfectly, we can now begin to focus on the unique physical properties that derive from their unique symmetry properties. So we've already seen that they have unique diffraction properties and unique faceting properties because of their unusual symmetries. But we've also learned from both theoretical analysis and from experiment is that they have unusual elastic and electronic properties. They are, for example, harder than crystals made of similar materials, similar atoms. They are much more resistant at low temperatures than crystals, and tend to trap electrons much more easily at localized sites much more easily than ordinary crystals, which can be useful for some applications. You yourself might find some practical application for quasicrystals. Turns out one of the properties that they have that we actually don't understand theoretically is that some of them are remarkably slippery. In fact, some of them are claimed to be the second most slippery material compared to Teflon. The only thing is, when you coat a pan with Teflon, we know Teflon's kind of delicate. You wouldn't want to take a knife to your Teflon pan. But when you coat a pan with quasicrystal, as these are, you can actually take a knife to that pan without damaging the surface, because it's just a metal alloy. In fact, it's a rather hard metal alloy. I should warn you, if you buy one of these things and you take a knife to it, you will find that there are scratches. However, the scratches are not a scratch in the quasicrystal alloy. What's happened is the alloy is so hard, some of your knife has rubbed off on the pan. I should point out. Okay, I realize I've run a little bit over, but I can't help but end up with one simple short epilogue example, one last toy I want to show you. I can't help show it to you because to me, what you're about to see is what I like to call the rarest object in the galaxy. Maybe the rarest object in the observable universe. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty confident about the galaxy. It's an example of what is called a photonic quasicrystal. It's a device which is designed to trap light. The word photonic implies light. It's designed to trap light of certain frequencies. Photonic crystals is actually a very big industry. People manufacture, scientists and engineers manufacture by hand devices made of rods, made of different metals and elements, which, in crystalline arrays, because it turns out the way light propagates through one of these arrays is that it bounces off of different surfaces and interferes with itself so that some frequencies get trapped while others pass through. This turns out to be a very useful kind of attribute, a useful element to have if you want to make a photonic circuit, a circuit in which you want to, instead of using electrons in your circuit, use light in your circuit. You want to be able to control, sometimes stop it, redirect, manipulate the light, and you need some device that can, with nearly 100% efficiency, do that. And the way that's done at the moment in the industry is through what's called a photonic crystal. Now, these photonic crystals, in order to trap visible light, have to be made microscopically small. Here we want to play the same game, but using a quasicrystal. Why? Because one of the problems with a photonic crystal is it's not very spherically symmetric. So if light happens to hit along one direction, it might get trapped. But the same light that hits slightly off may not be trapped. So you'd like to have something which is more spherically symmetrical. Well, the most spherically symmetrical symmetry you can have is icosahedral symmetry. So why not make a photonic crystal which is icosahedral rather than crystalline? That was our notion. The only problem is it's very expensive to make one of these microscopic devices. So instead, what we did is we made one out of plastic, which was sort of handheld size. Let's see if I can get it on here. Well, you can get some impression of it. Now, this device, because it's much bigger, because the spaces are much bigger, can't trap ordinary light. You're not seeing ordinary light trap in there. What it traps is microwave radiation. And because it's more spherically symmetric, in fact, it turns out that it traps it along essentially all possible directions in which the microwaves might hit it. And the nice thing is that if you solve this problem for microwaves, you can then think about, once you've perfected the design, you can then shrink it down to microscopic size so then it can work for light. So our notion was to begin big and then work our way small. Now, what makes this thing so rare? Well, first of all, no one would ever think to make a device like this ordinarily to trap microwave light. That's not the kind of light you want to trap. It's not dense enough. It doesn't carry enough information. So no ordinary society out there would try to make this intentionally. Why did we make it? Well, we had this interesting coincidence. First of all, we had this really neat device at one end of our campus, which is called a 3D printer. You can put any design into it, like one of our complicated quasicrystal designs, and it will turn it into plastic for you. So that was the first element. Secondly, we had people like me on the campus who were interested in both cosmology and quasicrystals. And why was that important? Because it turns out that my neighbor in cosmology has a nice microwave background laboratory designed to look at microwave radiation from the early universe. So he had a beautiful lab which generated microwave radiation, and which you could put this device in the middle of it and look at the scattering pattern. And I think there's almost nowhere else in the galaxy, maybe the visible universe, where you'd have this weird coincidence of people who work with plastic, some guy, some theorist who works with quasicrystals and cosmology, and then these cosmologists all working in the same place. I can't think of any place, certainly on this planet, where that would occur. And that's how this device came out. So I leave this to you as an example of another kind of future for application of these ideas, one in which, in a controlled way, we make these patterns intentionally, in this case, for controlling, manipulating, and channeling light. Turns out the idea is indeed successful, and so we are working on yet other patents and other uses of this idea for various purposes. And I'm going to leave this one up here. You're welcome to come up and look at it and handle it very gingerly, because it's the only one in the galaxy. Thank you.
Are there any organic materials that form quasicrystals?
We don't know. So we've just really begun the study of this whole class of materials with other symmetries. In fact, we've only seen so far only a few symmetries beyond the ones allowed by crystals. We've seen the example of the icosahedral symmetry in three dimensions, 5-10-fold symmetry in the plane, 8-fold symmetry in the plane, 12-fold symmetry in the plane. And so far, they've all been seen in metal alloys. However, that's highly biased by the fact that the people doing the investigations study metal alloys for the most part. So most of the quasicrystals that have been found so far have been studied by people who study metallic alloys. It's easy to make different mixtures of metallic alloys and study lots of examples very quickly. Whereas for biological molecules, we have, you know, less understanding, less predictability, less control. Some of the quasicrystals have been found, like the case of Shachman, through sort of systematic studies where they mix X, Y, and Z, where they have some, we have some idea why X, Y, and Z might be a good choice. But some of them are just found serendipitously. You weren't looking, and you happened to find one where you didn't expect to find it. The example I gave of the airplane alloy was a purely serendipitous example. Someone was analyzing the aluminum that's used in airplanes and discovered it had grains of this stuff in there.
Can you predict material properties in theory already? And is there any material design going on already?
Yes. I mean, I hinted a little bit at that at the end when I was saying that we understood something about the unique elastic properties of quasicrystals. So, for example, we know when you take a crystal and you try to bend it, the reason why it becomes bendable is because what happens is, as you introduce more and more stress, is that you begin to make defects in the material that begin to move around in the material to release the stress. And they move around easily through a crystal because a crystal has easy planes of symmetry in which the defects can move. But a quasicrystal does not. So when you try to bend a quasicrystal, you might be, if with a lot of stress, you might begin to make the defects, but they don't tend to run easily through the material. So it tends to be harder than the crystal analog. So that's an interesting, that's part of the reason why it's interesting use for example, coating, one of the reasons why it's of interesting use, for example, to coat a surface or something like that. That plus the fact that it's slipperier. For related reasons, electrons get more easily trapped in quasicrystals. So that means they have different electronic properties, especially as you change the temperature. They behave quite differently than crystals. Crystals become more ordered, and electrons flow more easily, and the opposite occurs for a quasicrystal. It becomes more resistant. So we have some theoretical understanding of these things. And now that we have a better understanding of how they're composed, we have more control in making them better and designing their properties. So the subject is still in its infancy. Now that we have a better understanding of what their structure is, now we have more control on how to make better ones designed for specific purposes. So if I were going to compare it to crystals we've known about for thousands of years, these we've only known for 20 years, it'll probably take us, you know, at least a century before we have really full control and command and heavy usage of these novel kinds of materials.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.